What's my subscription to the New York Times have me doing this week? Preparing a strawberry pretzel pie. Solving spelling bee with no hints. Planning a trip to one of the 52 best places to go. Getting to the bottom of the big pants trend.
Whoa.
And I'm finally replacing my vacuum with a recommendation I can trust. What will your subscription to the Times have you do? Why not find out? With our best offer, go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, every mass shooting in the U.S. is inevitably followed by a call for gun control. But it never happens. The story behind why the legislation always fails and the NRA always wins. And a gun shop owner talks about putting military-style weapons into the hands of civilians. It's Wednesday, October 4th. Robert, take me back to the early decades of the NRA. What role did the National Rifle Association play in American culture?
Well, originally, its role in American culture was purely recreational.
Robert Draper has reported on the NRA for the Times Magazine.
It was founded in 1871, basically as a means of teaching former Union soldiers how to be hunters, how to use their firearms to eat and to recreate.
So it's a hunting group, essentially.
It was a hunting group for basically 120 years. It wasn't until the 1960s that began to change with social unrest that led to the Gun Control Act of 1968.
And the burning of our churches will not deter us.
Yes, sir.
The bombing of our homes will not dissuade us.
Yes, sir.
The beating and killing of our clergymen and young people will not divert us.
Yes, sir.
The wanton release of their known murderers will not discourage us. We're on the move now.
Yes, sir.
Glory, hallelujah.
Yes, sir.
Glory, hallelujah.
Any doctors
in the room, please? We need you immediately. Are there any doctors?
We need ice cubes, too.
It's also worth remembering, Michael, that during that period of the 1960s were the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Robert F. Kennedy. The notion of guns being real agents of violence was a really resonant one at that point in American life.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
Today we begin to disarm the criminal and the careless and the insane.
And it was in that atmosphere in 1968 that Congress and President Johnson acted to pass the gun control legislation of 1968.
And some of you may be interested in knowing really what this bill does.
Which imposed stringent restrictions really for the first time on the ability to purchase firearms.
It stops murder by mail order. It bars the interstate sale of all guns and the bullets that load them. It stops the sale of lethal weapons to those too young to bear their terrible responsibility. We have come a long way. We have made much progress, but not near enough.
So how does the NRA, as a gun club, mostly focused on hunting, get involved in that?
What happened after that was that one of its most active members, Congressman John Dingell,
I'd like to begin with congratulations to Mr. Thomas and his staff for the successful negotiation.
Began to sound the alarm that perhaps there would be even more restrictions coming down the pike. So Dingell began to talk to other NRA members and said, look, we've got to quit acting just like sportsmen. If we're not careful, our firearms and the ability of what firearms we're able to have left will be severely curtailed. We need essentially to develop our own lobbying organization. We need to push back.
Thanks to you, the members and supporters of NRA, no national gun law has passed this year.
And it was really under that climate that a legislative lobbying organization of the NRA was founded in 1975.
It is not likely at this time that one will pass if we will stand together, shoulder to shoulder, for what is right.
And on top of that,
they were able to vote out the former leadership, which was suspected of having gone soft on the gun control issue.
The more mild-mannered, hunting-oriented leadership of the NRA were ousted that very same year and replaced with Second Amendment absolutists who began to employ the language of the slippery slope.
If you take my rifles, my shotgun, and my pistols away from me, are you going to take the bullets and arrows too?
That one law would surely be followed by another law.
And then what are you going to do then after that? Take the pocket knives, the hunting knives? You know, where's the stopping point?
And before you knew it, essentially all guns would be collected and taken away from Americans. So it was really the first time that we saw the NRA start to develop its political muscle. And in particular, that began to take place in 1986.
There are 4 minutes remaining.
When it passed the Gun Ownership Protection Act.
And the bill is passed and the motion reconsideration is laid upon.
Again, led by NRA member and influential Congressman John Dingell, a Democrat of Michigan. Congress set out to reverse what they believed were a lot of the deleterious provisions in the 1968 Gun Control Act.
An act to protect firearms owners' constitutional rights, civil liberties, and rights to privacy.
So it was a win all the way around for the NRA, except one bone was thrown to gun control people. One thing was agreed to by the NRA, and that's that machine guns be banned. There was the belief that, look, this is such a win overall. We are getting so much in return that really no one's going to care that much about machine guns. And yet it developed that that people did hold a grudge against the NRA for giving in.
For giving in on this, often bring for just this one provision of the law on machine guns. Why was that such a big deal for people inside the NRA?
If you accept them purely on their own terms, they really do believe that the right to bear arms should not be abridged by any kind of legislation. And so the notion of compromise is one that they say should not exist with a constitutionally sanctioned right.
Right, because from the outside, it seems easy to say, how are we debating background checks or selling guns to mentally ill people? Because these seem, to many people, like no-brainers as far as regulation goes. But they're saying at the NRA, look, this is just a pure constitutional matter.
Right. Well, they're saying something else too, Michael, which is that the people who are saying, hey, all we want to do, we're not trying to take away people's guns. We just want to be sensible with gun control legislation by, for example, closing loopholes in background checks. The argument that the NRA will often make to that is, let's take a closer look at the sincerity of those individuals who are saying that this is really all they want to do. And at this point, the NRA will point to legislators such as Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein from California, who has said on more than one occasion that, in fact, if she could muster the votes to ban firearms, then she would do so.
If I might pose a question to the senior senator from California, would she deem it consistent with the Bill of Rights for Congress to engage in the same endeavor that we are contemplating doing with the Second Amendment in the context of the First or Fourth Amendment, namely, would she consider it constitutional for Congress to specify that the First Amendment shall apply only to the following books and shall not apply to the books that Congress has deemed outside the protection of the Bill of Rights?
Senator, I've been on this committee for 20 years. I was a mayor for 9 years. I walked in, I saw people shot. I've looked at bodies that have been shot with these weapons. I've seen the bullets that implode. In Sandy Hook, youngsters were dismembered. Look. There are other weapons.
Right. In other words, give them an inch, it feels like the NRA is saying, and those who are trying to limit what can be sold will take a mile. So we got to double down, give nothing.
That's right. Clearly, they're not interested in remediating a particular problem, except insofar as, in their view, the problem is guns being in existence in America.
This does not prohibit, you use the word prohibit, it exempts 2,271 weapons. Isn't that enough for the people in the United States?
Mr. Chairman?
Do they need a bazooka? Do they need other high-powered weapons that military people use to kill in close combat? I don't think so. So I come from a different place than you do. I respect your...
So this seems like a good moment to talk about how the NRA reacts when there are mass shootings. Potentially, these are spasms of gun violence that could be the single biggest threat to the NRA, the most likely time you'd expect the organization to give an inch.
Yes. Yeah. Well, there is a time-honored playbook by the NRA after mass shootings, and we've seen this since Columbine in 1999.
Describe that scene. And
well, me and my friend Chris were just out during lunch, and we heard what sounded like firecrackers, and so we looked over and we saw some guys with guns creeping around a corner. He looked at us, and then he started shooting at us. And so we fell to the ground.
We're back on the air now with another update for you on the Columbine High School shooting in Littleton, Colorado.
If you are just joining us, two young men apparently dressed in long black trench coats opened fire about an hour and a half ago at a high school just outside of Denver in Littleton, Colorado. At least three students have been injured and possibly as many as eight. We know that victims have been taken.
Joining us now, NBC News correspondent Dan Abrams, who has just arrived in Littleton. Dan, what can you tell us?
It's an eerie sight to see so many sort of scenes from an everyday school event. You see kids walking around in gym attire. You see students still working out with their weight belts on, but you see a lot of tears.
Perhaps now America would wake up to the dimensions of this challenge, and we could prevent anything like this from happening again.
The first thing they do is a seemingly nothing, which is to remain silent.
Our words and our behavior will be scrutinized more than ever this morning. Those who are hostile towards us will lie in wait to seize on a soundbite out of context, ever searching for an embarrassing moment to ridicule us.
Knowing that any statement is probably not going to do any good, could, in fact, do more harm than good. Mm-hmm. What they will be doing instead during that period is checking to see what the political headwinds are, hearing whatever feedback they may be getting from, say, Republican leaders. If they begin to say to them, for example, this is going to be tough for us to just stay silent on, we may actually have to consider some legislation, then the NRA begins to go into action. But it does so quietly at first. Its first step is to mount a membership drive, to send out newsletters saying your Second Amendment rights are under attack yet again by a disingenuous Congress that wants to take away your firearms.
Never fight if you can avoid it. But when you must fight, don't lose. And when nothing less than freedom is at stake, we fight. We're millions of people just like you. We're the longest-standing civil rights organization in the U.S. Proud defenders of history's patriots. Protectors of the Second Amendment. Advocating the right to keep and bear arms. Advancing the shooting sports.
The upshot of this will be that they will be able to recruit new members and in turn have more membership dues in their war chest. And with this war chest, mm-hmm. they can then initiate a lobbying campaign against members of Congress, first to do all they can to halt any legislation in its tracks, and then secondly, to basically threaten legislators who intend to vote for the legislation so that they will not do so. And the senators generally are themselves convinced that it is a battle that they do not wish to fight. And they don't say so on the record, but they have certainly said that to me unattributed.
It happens like that. The police can't get there in time. How you defend yourself is up to you. It's your choice. But Mary Landrieu voted to take away your gun rights. Vote like your safety depends on it. Defend your freedom. Defeat Mary Landrieu. The NRA Political Victory Fund is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Robert, is this an actual playbook, what you're describing that the NRA is using? Is this more or less a codified strategy?
No, it's not written down, but it's so understood and has been repeated over and over with such success, beginning in 1999, because after Columbine, Bill Clinton tried to pass a background checks bill, but it happened that the president was still recovering from the Monica Lewinsky scandals in 1999. He was really no match for the power of the NRA. And so whatever political capital he had just simply wasn't enough. And the bill never made it out of the Senate.
And so that was a success for the NRA. And it becomes, as you said, a strategy that they use after every mass shooting going forward.
Yes, that continued to be the case after the shootings at Virginia Tech in 2007. Later, after the 2012 Newtown massacre, all of these were cases where there was a sentiment, particularly from the progressive side of the spectrum, that surely now there would be sensible gun control legislation. And when it did not eventuate, each time it did not eventuate, the legend of the NRA, as it were, began to grow. Their power seemed to be that much more unassailable for every obstacle that they were able to surmount.
So, ironically, as these mass shootings continue and in some ways become worse, they strengthen the National Rifle Association.
That's right. No, and in fact, it is historically the case that the NRA's membership has gone down when there isn't some kind of galvanizing moment for them. Whether that galvanizing moment is a Democratic president, the prospect of a Democratic president, or a shooting that spurs legislation largely by Democratic legislators. So yes, in a very twisted, perverse sense, these kinds of tragedies actually help grow the power of the NRA.
So to go back to the 1960s and bring this full circle, an organization that became politicized in the first place in response to the assassinations of these giant figures like Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy solidified power in response to these modern mass shootings.
Yes, the NRA as we know it today really came into being as a direct result of violence in America and legislators' attempts to do something about that violence. Before then, the NRA was a quiet, not so large organization, mainly devoted to hunting. The NRA as we know it today is an NRA that was born out of the violence, gun violence in America.
Thank you, Robert. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Michael.
Hey, is this John?
Yeah.
Hey, it's Michael Barbaro from the New York Times.
Okay, bye.
John, can you tell me about your store? Maybe just describe it to me.
You're talking about the gun shop?
Yeah.
We already had a number of shops in the area, so I decided I didn't want to sell the same thing they did, which was all hunting equipment. And so I started out by selling tactical equipment, like AR-15s or long-range rifles. I mean, I sold rifles that could shoot a mile. I sold $10,000 rifles. I sold $5,000 guns. I sold the upper end.
John Merkel owns a gun store in Roanoke, Virginia, that sells military-style weapons.
Oh, they're sexy. I mean, they're like a beautiful woman. Now, that's not all, but some are. They're all extraordinary.
So here's a question that I've been wondering about, knowing that I would be talking to you. I feel like I understand why people buy handguns, and I also understand why people buy hunting rifles to hunt. But I feel like I don't understand as well why people buy these kind of higher-powered guns. And it sounds like you carry some of those weapons.
Oh, I carry a lot of them. But you can't even hunt with
them. Why do people buy that sort of gun?
Oh, just for fun. That's all.
Just for, what do you
mean? Do you have any idea how much fun it is to take one out at 100, 200, 300, 400, even 500 yards and shoot with that.
So what you're describing, is kind of sport, not for hunting, not for self-defense.
No, just sport. But just more for sport than for any other reason. We simply have fun with them.
So when someone buys a gun like that, is that what you imagine they're doing with it?
For the most part, yes.
John, what's the process? If I walk into a store, me, Michael Barbaroff, yeah, and I want to buy an assault rifle or something like a machine gun, what happens?
Well, the first thing that happens is we size the person up. You have any idea how many sales we've lost just because we refused to sell the gun?
Hmm.
Something didn't smell right. We get lots of mad people. I mean, we've seen some really squirrely people. We just didn't feel right selling it, and with nothing other than a feeling to go on.
And how often does that happen?
Weekly, monthly.
Hmm.
I mean, it's ridiculous. It literally probably cost me $20,000 of what we turned down.
But so say I pass the kind of John visual test.
They're going to do two background checks, one's federal and one's state. Okay, we don't move until we hear them say yes.
And does that take some time?
For two-thirds, it doesn't. For a third, it does.
So it sounds like I could walk out with an assault rifle on the same day.
You can. In 15 minutes, because it's not the weapon. The weapon's a tool, no different than an axe. I mean, it's how you use it. I sold a gun. I wish I hadn't. The woman committed suicide, and she did it in our parking lot because she said she didn't want her children to find her. I didn't want to sell it, but I did sell it and didn't make any money on it. I just felt bad for her because of the story she gave me. She said people have been moving into her neighborhood. There's gunfire at night. I'm scared to death to leave my house. So I found a gun for her and I threw in a box of ammo. I lost money probably on her, and she's the one. Came back 11 days later when I wasn't there to ask the clerk that was there. She said, "How do you operate this gun? I can't make it work." So they showed her. She went right outside and committed suicide. It turns out she was bipolar and was off her meds.
John, this is a difficult question. You may not think it's fair, but did you feel guilty after she did that?
No. God, I wish she hadn't, obviously. No, because she would have done it anywhere. And the funny thing was, we were joking. We were laughing with each other when she was buying the gun.
I do want to ask you about 2007. Can you tell me about the gun that you sold on March 13th?
The Glock 19.
Yeah, to Sungwee Cho.
I talked to the clerk, and the clerk said that he was very quiet, hardly. Well, the way he described it was a typical college kid who finally was old enough to buy a gun. He was 21, so he could buy a gun.
When did you first hear about the shooting, the Virginia Tech shooting?
Well, it happened on a Monday. Well, you got to understand, I was listening from the whole thing, the news from the very beginning. One person was killed in the dorm, then there's two. Then a long, long gap, or seemed like it was a long gap, and then we hear there's 10, there's 15. It just kept going up and up, and I kept thinking, my God, it's got to stop.
Hmm.
And I had to deal with the ATF immediately, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. We didn't know it was us until ATF told us it was. And the only reason they knew is because he kept the receipt in his backpack.
Hmm.
So they brought that receipt directly to us. Of course, it looks exactly like all of our receipts. He bought the gun and one box of practice ammo.
Hmm.
And I mean, it was breaking my heart. My daughter graduated from Tech in 1997.
Wow.
I can't believe it.
It sounds like it was painful for you to realize.
It was painful. It was terribly painful. I was hurt. You have no idea. I don't know. They think that because I have a gun shop, I've got a mean streak, and I want to see people use it. I do want to see people use it to kill animals for eating. You don't kill if you don't eat it. And one shot, one kill. I gave up killing for food, even though I ate everything I killed. I gave up hunting because of an incident where I did not kill a deer on the first shot. It took two. And that poor deer had to suffer for 10 minutes. I didn't want that on my conscience at all. So no more hunting.
You're describing a feeling of guilt when a living thing is shot.
I don't like any living thing shot. How about if I tell you that one of the people that took my class and bought a gun from me saved his wife's life with his gun? That's just one story that I know. So that negates some of the negative publicity. It doesn't kill it, but it doesn't get reported. If something good with the gun doesn't get reported. I get a magazine from the NRA, and one of the pages in it is just nothing but people using guns to defend themselves or the people they love.
I understand what you're saying, which is that guns can be used to defend and protect as much as in your mind as they can be used to hurt and to damage. But does what happened at Virginia Tech weigh on your conscience because your gun shop sold the gun to the shooter?
No, because the way the system is built, he could have bought it 5 miles from where he lived. I don't know why he picked us. I have no idea. But because he would have been okayed by the two background checks, it would have been the same no matter where he went. He could have bought that gun anywhere, and it didn't make any difference. We all would have let him have it.
Does that mean that there's something wrong with the background testing system, with the law?
It means there's something wrong with the people reporting to the background. There's nothing wrong. The FBI is doing a great job of that. That's not the problem. The problem is enough people aren't reporting these things. Now, he should have been reported by at least four people.
Because of his behavior.
Yes, two teachers and at least one student. And I don't know why people keep forgetting that. All any of them had to do was just say one word to somebody that carried some weight for the school, and his name would have been on the do not sell to list.
John, after you went through that, selling that gun, your shop, to Cho, and then hearing about the Virginia Tech shooting, did you keep your gun store open? Is that something you thought about, whether to keep it open?
I kept it open. Almost had to. I had one fellow that drove from Northern Virginia, it was a 4-hour drive, 3.5 to 4 hours, to buy a gun that he could have bought 10 miles from his house.
So after that shooting, the Virginia Tech case, did gun sales actually go up at your shop?
By a factor of 10.
Wow. I want to ask you, John, about the period since Virginia Tech. Every time there's a mass shooting, and there are mass shootings now many times a year in the United States. Let's take the examples of what happened in Orlando or what just happened in Las Vegas. I want to understand what goes through your mind.
Anytime I hear about a shooting, same thing goes through yours. There's no difference.
The Times reports that Stephen Paddock, the shooter who killed at least 59 people in Las Vegas on Sunday night, used multiple semi-automatic rifles, weapons that fire a single round with each pull of the trigger. At least one of those rifles was outfitted with a device that would enable it to fire hundreds of rounds per minute. Here's what else you need to know today. On Tuesday, the Supreme Court held opening arguments in the first case of its new session, a debate over partisan gerrymandering in Wisconsin, where Republicans drew the state's voting districts to give themselves a lopsided advantage in legislative elections. During the hearing, Justice Anthony Kennedy considered the crucial vote in the case, asked questions that indicated he could join the four more liberal justices in ruling that the courts can determine when lawmakers have gone too far in drawing those voting districts. And...
Well, thank you very much. It was a great trip and a beautiful place.
After weeks of frustration about the pace of federal relief efforts in Puerto Rico, President Trump spent 4 hours on the island on Tuesday and addressed its residents directly.
Every death is a horror. But if you look at a real catastrophe like Katrina, and you look at the tremendous hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that died. And you look at what happened here with really a storm that was just totally overpowering. Nobody's ever seen anything like this. And what is your death count as of this moment? 17?
16 certified.
16 people certified. 16 people versus in the thousands. You can be very proud of all of your people, all of our people working together. 16 versus literally thousands of people.
Trump spoke to the recovery work of the federal government.
Now, I hate to tell you, Puerto Rico, but you've thrown our budget a little out of whack.
And at one stop, he handed out supplies, tossing rolls of paper towels into a crowd and distributing flashlights.
Flashlights! You don't need them anymore! You don't need them anymore!
That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.